Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Uzbekistan, known for many things. It is the most populous Central Asian country. It has a rich culture and history, and it's also known for its vast cotton fields, as well as the largest number of people it forcefully deploys to pick those cotton. But the new Uzbek president, Shavkat Mirziyoyev, wants to change the culture of forced labor. He pledged to eradicate it. It's been over a year since, so where we are on that promise? What changed, what remains to be changed, and what are the challenges going ahead? Today we are here to do a quick states update and reality check involving those questions. To do so, I'm joined by Jonas Astrup, who is the Chief Technical Advisor of International Labor Organization in Uzbekistan. Umida Niyazova, Director of Uzbek-German Forum for Human Rights, who runs one of the largest monitoring program involving forced labor in Uzbekistan's cotton fields. Laziz Omilov, he is in charge of our Uzbek Services Special Reporting Project on Uzbek cotton called Paxtagram. Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia Blog, Kishlok Owozi. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. So, State Department dropped Uzbek cotton from the child labor list. It is something, a reflection of some sort of progress. How does this progress look like on the ground? Let's start with you, Jonas.
The harvest has begun here in Uzbekistan. And from what we hear, some 2.6 million people will be involved in the harvest this year. So the harvest started a little later than usual, but it's now underway and our monitoring has begun in the fields. So this year, we are indeed, in previous years, as people probably will be familiar with, the ILO monitoring was conducted by international ILO monitors together with the Federation of Trade Unions and a translator and a driver on each monitoring team. And we were driving around the cotton fields conducting interviews. That we are also doing this year. But there's a new development in that we no longer have the Federation of Trade Unions with us on the teams. Instead, we have independent human rights activists with us conducting the monitoring. And as we speak, monitoring teams are in the fields asking these questions. And I'd be happy to discuss that further, how we conduct the monitoring and what are some of the preliminary findings we are seeing already.
Thank you, Jonas. I thought we will get to this topic, monitoring aspect of the discussion, a little bit later. But since you raised it, let me get Umida's thoughts, perhaps suggestions on the way ILO is planning to do the monitoring. Because I remember from our earlier conversations that some people have second thoughts on the way ILO could improve the crucial work it's doing on the ground. Umida, any thoughts?
No questions so far. I just wanted to welcome these developments and welcome the invitation of independent activists to ILO monitoring. And I hope that the information they will be able to find will be accepted and will be written in a final ILO report.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Jonas, you said 2.6 million people will be involved in cotton this year, as per your report. Who those people will be?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And of course, I mean, let me start by explaining to you what we found last year about who the people are that pick the cotton in Uzbekistan. So according to our findings last year in 2017, what we could see is that the majority of pickers are voluntary. And I'm sure that many people will question that. But that is the results that we find when we do quantitative data research. We find that the majority of pickers are voluntary. They are predominantly women from rural areas who see the cotton harvest as an opportunity to earn an extra cash income, or in many cases, this is the only opportunity to generate a cash income throughout the year. But that said, there is a significant number of people who are not participating in the harvest voluntarily. So in 2017, we found that 13% of the pickers, the equivalent of approximately 336,000 people, were harvesting cotton involuntarily. It's quite important to look at that number and understand that the majority of the involuntary pickers, 80% of them, in fact, are staff from state budget institutions. So nurses, teachers, doctors, students, etc. So that's the high level overview according to our methodology. I think that was the situation in 2017. Now, there has been some developments since, and so we are now seeing a ring fencing of certain groups of staff from state budget institutions. So students, nurses, doctors, teachers can no longer be recruited for cotton picking. So that, in theory, should address, you know, a big part of the problem. The question remains, who is going to replace them? Because obviously the cotton will still need to be picked.
Okay, so Omid, you already released one part of your report. It's also really early to make any comparison with previous years since the cotton season has just started. So as per your initial information, who are the people being mobilized and what are the percentage of them voluntary and what are the percentages involuntary? And the bottom line is there any change compared to the previous year?
Thank you. I just wanted to mention that so my organization conducts independent monitoring of forced labor during every cotton harvest. And last year, we estimate around one third of from the total amount of pickers, they've been forced to pick cotton. This is around 1 million people. And our methodology is very different from ILO methodology. And we questioned ILO methodology a lot. And now I can share with some information we have received so far. Yes, so the positive development that employees of educational medical institutions, which have been the most affected in previous years, are not involved in cotton harvest, but this is the only first week of the harvest. Wow. And from our experience, we always see that the peak period for coercion is usually in the middle and the end of the harvest when the number of voluntary workers decreases. So at the moment, I receive many convincing evidences that local authorities are still coercing employees of various state and private organizations throughout the country to go to pick cotton or hire a collector in their place. So although the payment to the pickers was raised to 8 cents per 1 kilogram of cotton, it seems that voluntary pickers in those numbers cannot be found. So today, the main burden of compulsory mobilization of pickers lies with community leaders, so it's mahalla leaders, the National Youth Organization, Union of Youth, tax inspections, bank employees, and also budget organizations and private enterprises around the country.
Okay.
And also, I wanted to mention that I received the many so-called statements. So people write before to go to pick cotton, so employees of different organizations are writing statements confirming their voluntary participation in the cotton harvest. So this was special efforts being made to show that employees of different organizations are going to the fields voluntarily. But these people who wrote this statement, they said that they just don't have other options. So they're afraid to be fired. They write this statement and go to the fields.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I don't want to interfere with your interview, but maybe I can just say, just as a very, very quick follow-up to Amita, that we don't, in the monitoring, pay attention or assign a lot of value to those statements about people writing that they're voluntary or not. You know, quite frankly, it's a piece of paper. What is far more important is to have a structured interview to find out what's really going on.
Okay. So my other guest, Laziz Khan Omilov, also knows very well what's going on behind those papers because he runs one of the largest reporting projects on forced cotton labor in Uzbekistan called Paxtagram. So Laziz, first of all, tell me about your project. How does it work and what does it do?
Yes, the Uzbek service of RFRL, Ozodli, has got the biggest citizen journalist network in Uzbekistan. We have over 10,000 people daily reporting to us through different platforms, Telegram, Instagram, Facebook, and etc. So I would say it's different from ILO methodology or MIDAS methodology. As you know, we have no reporters on ground, but we created, let's say, technological way of reporting, like Alisher, my director, always says, Uber for everybody. So basically, we keep receiving around 500 messages daily from people all around Uzbekistan, from every corner. We ask them every time to include photos, videos, documents, and any evidence they have. After Mirziyoyev came to power, this project started giving, let's say, real fruits, results, because Uzbek government was reacting to these reports and resolving them and working on them. This is one part. And we noticed that the intensity of these messages increased since 18th of September, 19th, I would say. Now we, in a regular mode, we keep receiving like around 500 messages daily from all around Uzbekistan.
Okay, great. So UNAS is in Uzbekistan in the field. Omida runs the biggest monitoring organization when it comes to cotton. And Laziz has the largest network of citizen journalists in Uzbekistan. So we couldn't have a better panel to discuss this topic today. Very privileged. Thank you very much, colleagues. So in terms of people being deployed, the initial signs, so tell me what is happening. What changes have you seen?
When it comes to kids, like the biggest problem that Uzbekistan was having previous years, yet so far we didn't receive any report saying that any kid was forced to go on the field. So basically, we didn't notice any kids being forced to pick a cotton. This is very positive development on one side. Generally, what we saw, regional government started giving sort of option, choice to people. Either you send somebody or you go yourself. But let me jump on real cases that we were having these days. They are very interesting. Just yesterday, one of our journalists was researching and wrote an article about young people who were taken to cotton fields from different companies and delegated from other places. And they claimed that they were not given convenient facilities, conditions. So basically, they directly claimed that they were not given food for 3 days, no water, no opportunity for laundry, and so on. So basically, in terms of conditions, we didn't see any change. So basically, it's still, again, either schools. In this case, it was former camp for kids. So these people were held there. Just a few days ago, we're writing about the case in the city of Kagan in Bukhara region, where the bus with 26 women just blowed up. So there was a problem with gas balloon in the car, some technical problem, but 5 people died. And Uzbek government gave official statement saying that it happened while it was on contract base, and these ladies were going for corn picking, for picking a corn. But after some investigation, several sources reported that these 26 women were taken for picking cotton. So 5 of them died, and government gave 10 million sum to each family, which is like $1,300 approximately, to those who died. This is one case. It's like already like confirmed cases. We even saw that one of imams in Tashkent, one of the imams of Tashkent Mosque, just before the campaign started, mentioned very interesting thing during his interview to one of the state channels. He said, instead of criticizing us imams or the government, it would be better to take these young people from social media and bring them all to the cotton. So even religious and spiritual leaders started talking about this. We have farmers from Andijan who claim that they are forced to attend agricultural meetings on a daily basis at 6 a.m. and then at 10 p.m. in the evening. We have a number of entrepreneurs from all around the Republic who claim that they are forced to contribute to the cotton campaign by money. They say that they claim that tax officers come to their shops, and they say the numbers are very different. The minimum that we received in the report was 400,000 sums, which is around $50. And the max was from Beg Baraka Bazaar, which is in Tashkent, where shop owners claim that tax officers came and collected 1 million sums, which is a little bit more than $100, from each shop owner for cotton. They claim that if you refuse giving money, they say, we are going to cut off you from electricity. We are going to create you a lot of problems when tax reporting time comes. Some people from state collectors, MIB, called Majburi Icra Bürosu in Uzbekistan, state debt collectors in Fergana claim that they are forced to find and send at least two people for cotton campaign for 10 days. So they are not forced to go themselves to pick a cotton, but they are forced to find a person or pay some certain amount of money so that they can finance somebody instead of him. We have several claims from Andijan, Namangan, from taxi drivers who say that police officers just stop them, take their documents and ask them to go to the field, pick up five people, bring them to the local school, to this hub, to the collection area. And only after that, they return their documents. We have several reports from teachers all around the Republic that they are not forced to pick a cotton, but they are again forced to pay some certain amount of money or send a person instead of them. I can continue nonstop. Like there are so many names and sources and so on. But what I'm trying to say that, yes, there are some changes, but I would say the methods of extortion, the method of involving people changed. So there is active involvement and non-active involvement, I would say.
Wow. Omida, what your sources say about these methods?
Yeah, they're almost the same. So I just today received information. Our monitors, they talked with employees from 15 branches of the banks. Most of them, they've been told to hire somebody to go to the technical staff, they're going to pick cotton themselves, and the kind of middle staff, they have to hire somebody to send to harvest cotton. And yeah, we have an interview. So the employee of Promstroy Bank in the city of Nukus, she said that her 60 years old mother went to pick cotton for 5 days in her place. And she said, now I'm looking for a hired worker to send him to field and bring your mother back. So yeah, many like interviews and conversations. So, and as I mentioned, this is just the beginning of the harvest, and we are collecting all the information to analyze this. But what we can say that unfortunately, government was not able to kind of to attract voluntarily cotton pickers and do this cotton harvest without coercion.
Wow, thanks, Omida. Bruce, feel free to jump in whenever you see relevant. But Omida and Laziz's points earlier kind of leads me back to Ioannis's remarks, in which you spoke some measures government is taking to address these issues. Then why is these problems keep repeating again? How to explain this contradiction in government's claims and their actual actions?
Yes, so I completely appreciate that for people listening to this podcast who may or may not have been to Uzbekistan or who may or may not have seen the cotton harvest firsthand, this may indeed seem quite contradictory. How can you on the one hand side have, you know, the central government saying one thing and then you hear these cases coming from the provinces and the districts? And I think that's a really good discussion. So I had the pleasure of meeting with the Prime Minister of Uzbekistan 2 weeks ago. We were invited to observe a meeting of the cabinet ministers where the cotton harvest planning were discussed and agreed upon. I think if I can quote the Prime Minister, he was quite realistic about the way he spoke about this. He said, this is a process. We must realize that it's going to take time because we're dealing with legacy systems and we need to change the way people think. He said, and I quote him again, he said, we have no illusion that this is going to somehow happen by magic. It's a process and we must begin our work now, and it is not reversible. So I actually think that is a fair statement. Now, you know, I listened to all the examples just given, and it seems like I often find that this is the kind of discussion that you have about the cotton harvest. There are lots of examples coming forward. And some of them are probably true, and some of them are maybe a little bit different or not true. Who knows? You need a proper investigation in each case to really find out what is going on. I think there's no doubt that there are people being mobilized for the cotton harvest this year that are not voluntary. I think that's very, very clear. The Ministry of Labor has a hotline, and in the week last week, they received 110 cases that were confirmed, and the Federation of Trade Unions have a similar hotline with similar numbers coming in. So even just from these government hotlines, we see hundreds of cases being reported. So it's no surprise that you see these cases. What is important is to, one, distinguish between, is this driven by a central government policy and central government systems, or are these cases violations or incidents that are initiated at the local level? And
why it matters for someone who's forced to be important because
the response is different. So if this is a case of central level government policy, the response from the international community is different than if it's a case of local instances violating the central level policies. So, you know, exercising pressure, using diplomacy, these are the kind of responses you would be using if it was a central government-led phenomenon. Whereas if these are local level violations and the government is actually doing what it can to change people's minds, to change these practices, to sort of turn the ship around, if you like, then pressure on the central government is perhaps not the most appropriate response. Rather, support and training and capacity building is what's needed. So I think it is important to look at these differences. I appreciate that for the person at the receiving end, it may not make such a big difference. But from a macro level, it certainly is important to have that distinction.
Yeah, let's have the way forward thing a little bit later. Omida, I know you want to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to state that all the information was with Uzbek German Forum provide, and it was given in our reports, are very good checked. It's for us, it's very, very important to be correct, because this is only what we have. So we have to be very super correct, and we give only right information in our reports. And regarding this question, if this order to coerce, to force people to pick cotton comes from central government or not. One example, I think it was a few days ago, there was a big article at the Ozotlik, when the tax inspector, he's describing the situation very clearly. He said, I received an order to fine 50 pickers. And I go house to house, and people, I'm not able to find so many people to work voluntarily. And I'm trying to explain, to discuss with the people who are working on the markets, entrepreneurs, and he's asking them to help him to find people or to pay money. And he's saying that when I turn on the television, so I see the video Rolex when it says that forced labor is prohibited and you can complain to prosecutor, to ministry of labor or whatever, but at the same time my own director says me, if you will not find these 50 pickers, you will be fired. So I think that this central government is also responsible for this situation. Yeah. And can't just say that we didn't give the order to force people to pick up.
Yeah, obviously central government, in my opinion, too, matters, because at the end, the president is the guy who shuts the fire. So, Bruce, in fact, you did work on those cotton fields, as far as I remember from our previous discussions. But one striking point is that so far, the reportings that we got from Uzbekistan, it looks like situation in Qashqadarya, Jizzakh kind of strikes out in terms of the effect of this mobilization. What makes that region different compared to the others?
Well, Jizzakh, of course, is where Mirziyoyev comes from.
Yeah.
So, you know, that would be one thing. If there was going to be one showcase area where the situation would be turning around, I imagine the Uzbek president would want that to be the one area. You know, although I would say even then, you know, we get some information, as all our guests have already said. You know, they can see large, sometimes many pieces of this puzzle and sometimes just limited pieces of this puzzle. But, you know, it's already become clear that, you know, the central government, fine, they come on, Mirziyoyev comes out and stuff, says, we're not going to do this anymore, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. But at the same time, they're telling local officials, you know, all the way down to, you know, the heads of mahalas that, you know, you got to come up with this much cotton at the end. The quota system is still there, you know, so it's kind of strange to balance this thing. The government saying, you know, all the right things that we want to hear about, you know, no use of forced labor, but at the same time, they're imposing these responsibilities on local officials. We've all been to Uzbekistan and we know how this kind of stuff works. People are terrified sometimes to report the fact that they are doing this. There's a number of ways that that local officials can pressure people into going out and not saying anything about what's happening. Now, I agree that this has been going on for years and years. There's no way you can change this overnight. But you know, every now and then, I get the feeling anyway that the Central Asian government is trying to portray itself as absolutely the good guy in this. And then when somebody just unfortunately gets caught, at like the tax collector we just heard about or something like that, you know, for trying to force people to go out in the fields, you know, then all of a sudden they're the bad guy. You know, here's somebody who didn't listen to what the central government said, omitting the fact that the central government also explained to them that they had to meet these kind of figures at the, you know, in the meantime. So it's a tough question. I mean, you know, I would be happier. I'm glad the Central Asian government's doing it. I know Yunus has put pictures up on Twitter of the signs that tell people that if they're being forced out there, you know, road sign, billboards, if you're being forced into the cotton fields, you know, you should report this. I'm glad to hear there's spots on TV saying this, you know, but what's said when someone knocks on your door and says, I need people or I need money, you know, and it's understood that if you can't help me out with one of those two things, you know, as Lizzie said, your electricity could go out, you know, you could lose your job, all kinds of things. That's pretty terrifying to a lot of people. So, and one last note, I do applaud the fact that they raised the salary for picking cotton. It's a good first step.
Yeah. Is it really making a difference? Who wants to take this question?
Well, I can, whether or not it makes a difference, I think that is yet to be seen, of course. But the wages have been raised significantly this year, and so in a number of ways. So in 2016, the rate for picking cotton it was 280 sums per kilo. What happened in 2017 is that went up to 450 sums per kilo in the first pass of the harvest. This year, the rate has gone up to 650 sums per kilo in the first pass of the harvest. And in high-risk areas, like Jisak, by the way, speaking about Jisak, Jisak is a high-risk area because of their low-yield cotton production and low density of population. In Jisak, the rate for picking cotton this year is 950 sums per kilo in the first pass and up to 1,300 later in the harvest. So I think just to add maybe on top of that, cotton picking wages have been made tax exempt this year. So there's another 8-9% deduction that was deducted in 2017, which is no longer deducted in 2018.
Note that this is maybe one step towards the right direction. But, you know, I'm thinking about what difference this compensation really makes, because at the end, the bulk of this payment is coming from people who agrees to pay instead of being forced to pick cotton. So there is difference between in terms of suffering of people, the effect of this mobilization to the people.
Look, this is a good point, and thank you for making it, because many people have raised cases of people being asked for money. So let me make it very clear. From an ILO legal definition perspective, that is forced labor. It's a negative consequence of refusing an invitation to perform the work. So it's forced labor if somebody asks you to pay for a replacement picker or in any other way, shape or form, contribute to, you know, in terms of money. That's clear. We have not been able to find any evidence that is a centrally organized, orchestrated effort to collect money. Rather, to be very frank, I think in most of these cases, they are simply cases of corruption and extortion. So some people in Uzbekistan say that it's not just the cotton that's being harvested and people are harvesting other things. And I think there are people, opportunists, who simply use the cotton harvest as an opportunity to collect some money. Now, it is still, of course, the effect is the same. It's a forced labor situation, but the collection of money, I believe is a slightly different issue, and it may not be a labor issue.
Wow. So if this all wrongdoings are happening without knowledge of central government, I think it in itself is a huge question. Anyway, so this is the... briefly, yeah.
Just wanted to add a quick one. You know that Uzbekistan, it's like a compulsory conscription system. We have information that from several sources that they were called by this Marshall Committee today, asked to come to the office, and they were told that we need to copy your passport. And once they come there, they bring those young people directly for 1 month serving, because in Uzbekistan we have paid version of army, let's say, like a serving, and you serve there for 1 month, and of course you pay a certain amount of money. We received several information before reports that soldiers who are serving for 1 month on a paid basis, they are forced also to go to be cut.
Thank you very much. So this is the ground reality. I believe we all agree that the child labor is not an issue anymore, but forced labor in general remains a hectic question. If President Mirziyayev's May 29 speech taken into account, it looks like he is very serious in his plan to eradicate it. But what is the challenge? We will continue the discussion talking about this and many other solution-oriented questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis. I'm joined by Jonas Astrup, Chief Technical Advisor of International Labor Organization in Uzbekistan, Umida Niyazova, Director of Uzbek-German Forum for Human Rights, Laziz Omilov, in charge of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Uzbek Services Cotton Project called Pakhtagram, Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlak Owazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing forced labor in Uzbekistan's cotton fields, how authorities are trying to address this question in ways in which this can be addressed. So talking about President Mirziyayev's intention and also his challenges. Umida, this is exact translation of Mirziyayev's speech from your website. He says on his May 29th speech, public organizations will never touch cotton. Even if they get close to the cotton fields, they will not touch it. Who needs cotton? Private enterprise. Let their people go and pick it. Abdullah Nematovich, I believe he's one of the responsible person there. So he says, Abdullah Nematovich, you have a month. We punish ourselves with child labor. What's more important, 2-3 billion or political reputation? We do not need child and forced labor. There are many enterprises. Let them pick cotton. So there are number of questions in this statement. Let's deal one by one. So his order that employees of public organization will not touch cotton is not reflected in reality as we discussed. Is that correct understanding, Umida?
Yes, this is correct. Actually, since the beginning of this year, there were many promises made by the president, by other high-ranking officials, and these special measures have been taken, like to attract voluntary pickers. And it was said that additional money has been allocated to increase payment to pickers. And actually, even like me, who are very skeptical, but it was a hope that maybe all these measures would help to end forced labor in 2018. But unfortunately, the harvest started a week ago, and we see that the many public government institutions, they received a quota, they have to send their people to pick cotton. I remember many years ago when there was, for example, massive child labor, the government officials, they absolutely denied this fact. No, there is no child labor, no, you are lying. And then in 2014, child labor was stopped. Then they started to say, when we had been telling about around 1 million forest cotton pickers, they're saying together with ILO, no, there is no so many, and central government is not involved. Actually, central government are involved because, for example, the order to hire for the bank employees, the order comes from the central bank, and the central bank, it can't do this order without the government permission, especially in the country like Uzbekistan.
If I could just say that there's one thing I'd just like to pick up on. Umida, ILO has never said that there is no forced labor in the cotton harvest in Uzbekistan. I mean, just a few minutes ago, I told you that we found 336,000 cases in 2017.
No, we agree on that, Jonas. But there was a question about the role that central government is playing. On the other thing, maybe let me come to Jonas to you. Again, coming back to the President Mirziyoyev's 29th May speech, in which he also says that who needs cotton? Private sector. If so, let them deal with it. You know, if Mirziyoyev is really serious about privatizing this sector, why he just picks up an organization, private organization, and let them deal with it? Why still bank employees, public organizations, teachers or medics are involved in that? Why just hand this over to the private sector?
Yeah. Well, look, Mohammed, I'm not speaking on behalf of the Uzbek government. And in fact, if I can make a proposal, is I would be very happy to get, you know, the Minister of Labor or Deputy Minister of Labor to participate in a future discussion. I think it would be a good addition to this debate to have the voice of the government on this podcast. So let me offer that to you. And, sure. And I would be happy to do my best to facilitate. Now, trying to answer your question. And again, it's not for me to defend or to explain government policy. But we know for a fact that there is a number of textile clusters being implemented. So those are areas that are described as pilot projects currently. I believe there are some 27 of them currently. And in those cluster areas, the production has been handed over, you could say, to a private investor who basically would undertake procuring the cotton from the farmers and then process it further. I think that's really one of the key drivers, is to have move up the value chain, create jobs, and rather than exporting raw cotton, Uzbekistan, you know, it's obvious to everybody, should, of course, aim to export T-shirts and socks and shirts and what have you. So what you just described is happening on a pilot basis. And so there's definitely some initiatives going on to make that reality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Bruce, we are way over time. Let's conclude this with a couple of following points. You know, Mirziyoyev seems to be at least looking into his statement that just I read. I agree with him, and I believe his intention that he wants to really eradicate this problem from Uzbekistan. If he wants to do that, what are the ways to resolve this question? What is the first step that he should start with? Then I will take opinions from other panelists on the same question.
Well, you know, one thing, not specifically the statement that he made in May, but he's also said several times that he just wants cotton production to be reduced greatly. You know, that this shouldn't be one of the crutches that the economy is leaning on to begin with. So, yes, you know, as far as produce, not just producing cotton, but producing textiles, finished products that they can export, that's a good start. But mechanization, of course, is something else that's really good. You know, you can get one machine that can perform the work that, you know, 100 workers could do or something in a day, maybe more. But most importantly, I really would like to hold him to the fact that he wants to just reduce cotton production and wean Uzbekistan off of that as being a major source of income for its economy, because this is a loser crop for the whole region and has been. The cotton production prior to the arrival of the Russians was minimal in Central Asia, and Russia made Central Asia into the cotton fields of the Soviet Union eventually. A lot of the ecological problems that Central Asia suffers from right now find their origins in mass production of cotton, mass growing of cotton, you know, for the last 150 years. So that's what I would really like to see. Uzbekistan can produce many, many other things that are just as valuable, if not more valuable, than what they get for cotton or even finished cotton products. The benefits from cotton production do not outweigh the detriments that it has caused to the region. So I'd really like to see him hold to that and say, look, we're going to get off cotton. It's a poor man's crop. We'll grow enough that we can keep people employed, you know, by producing textiles. But this is no longer a main crop for Uzbekistan, and we're going to phase it out over the course of the next 10 or 15 years.
Okay, on the same question, And I also want someone to address this issue. We discussed this a little bit in the first half of the discussion that, you know, Mirziyayev seems to be genuine in addressing this question, but local authorities are not really following the order or the steps put forward by the central government. But again, as a president, I believe Mirziyayev has to take responsibility. And he has to take actions accordingly that if he is genuine, his orders are followed, that he eradicates this problem. Otherwise, I don't see how it's happening. So what are the challenges that he's facing in terms of the implementation of his plan, Jonas, and what kind of steps he can or he should take?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd like to say that to answer your question, I do agree with Bruce, what he said. Mr. Orev has inherited a huge legacy, and one of them is this almost monocrop agricultural system. So definitely, I agree with Bruce, reduce cotton production. The government has a goal of reducing it by 20% by 2020. So there's already a target in place there. Moving up the value chain, as we talked about, Uzbekistan needs jobs. There are 500,000 young people joining the labor market every year. It's borderline impossible to create 500,000 new jobs on an annual basis. So it needs all the jobs it can. Move up the value chain, create those jobs in manufacturing for the time being. I think increasing wages, hugely important. Engaging civil society in an open dialogue and raise awareness of these issues, make sure that people are aware of their labor rights. I think that's critically important. Overall, I think it's about normalizing employment relationships. I think we need to get to a state where you have market-driven solutions, where you have people in general being employed in a regular manner. And I think that when we have reached that stage, that's where we are going to see a sustainable solution to the problem.
Okay. I think you cleverly avoided my question, but that's fine. Umide, what's your thoughts? So what are the way forward to address this issue if president is really serious?
Yeah, a lot of should be done. As one farmer who I interviewed recently, he said that I interview him actually every year, and he said that you're always fighting with the consequences, but the root of the problem is farmers' situation. And first of all, so farmers who are growing all the crop, so they're not able to choose if they want to grow cotton or not. So they're also kind of the victims of forced labor. They must grow cotton even if it's not beneficial for them. So, and this is the root of the problem. And so why farmers are not able to attract voluntary workers? Because simply the cotton is not profitable for them. They can't just go to the market where many people are staying and looking for a job and hire that many young people to work. They simply don't have money. So the whole cotton system, this command administrative economy should be changed. I just wanted to mention that my organization, we are part of the cotton campaign, and the cotton campaign developed recommendation mm-hmm. for the roadmap of reforms to end the systematic use of forced labor. And they send this document to the government officials in May this year. And we're really looking for these real serious steps to reform cotton sector in Uzbekistan.
Has there been any response by the authorities to those recommendations? You forwarded that a couple of months ago, I believe.
No, I think there was no mm-hmm. response.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So,
I think there was a response. I think there was a delegation from the cotton campaign that was here in Tashkent for a week and had numerous meetings with the government officials, presented the roadmap suggestions, and there were discussions about it and feedback given from the government.
I mean that there was no response if they're really going to implement this roadmap and what's the government opinion on all these activities which was proposing to the government.
Okay.
Well, I think, Mohammed, I appreciate that you're way over time, but if I can just say, I think it's perfectly valid to write recommendations on a piece of paper. But I must say that the challenge is on the ground, implementing, changing systems, changing the way people think, and really driving that change on the ground. I must say, we have been training 7,000 people on fair recruitment this year. We have been training 500 public prosecutors. We've been training 250 journalists. We've been training 300 labor inspectors. And we have been training the civil society, human rights activists numerous times. It's hard work. This is not an easy fix, getting on the ground, doing real work, changing the way people think, that is what's needed.
There are lots of people, Jonas, that who wants to get on the ground and work there, but there are restrictions for them to do that. Like people are not able to get visa, work permits, accreditations. So yeah, there are lingering questions to do that. And Laziz, final points from you on ways forward.
Well, I certainly join what Jonas and what Bruce said about mechanization, technological development for producing the final products, for producing because Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan doesn't have enough technologies for producing final products. So I believe that it makes them to try to collect more and to export more because they cannot produce it at home. But there is another thing that I paid attention to regarding this technological development mechanization. It's hard to tell you the year, but back then when Shavkat Mirziyoyev was prime minister, there was an annual cotton fair in Tashkent where Prime Minister Mirziyoyev back then said that by 2016, almost 90% of cotton in Uzbekistan will be collected just by machines. Mm. I don't see that this is happening, but I believe that maybe it would be a nice idea to start at least with this, because again, we keep receiving reports from people, from farmers, saying that we have no enough tractors, we don't have enough machines to collect. Mm. But I have to highlight something what central government is doing. Now, from 2016, when Mirziyoyev came to power, he really started trying to invest more into agriculture, not to cotton, but to different products. He was trying to, and I believe that it's still happening, he was trying, for example, to import a lot of saffron, if I'm not mistaken in English, to develop this culture in Uzbekistan. So Mirziyoyev himself, I think, understands what should be changed. And I believe that it's not very quick process, but it would be a nice idea to start at least with something what was promised years ago, at least with mechanization. Okay. So far, we don't see that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Laziz Omilov, in charge of Ozotlik, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Uzbek services special reporting project on Uzbek cotton called Paxtagram. Also, big thanks goes to Jonas Asrup, Chief Technical Advisor of International Labor Organization in Uzbekistan, Umida Niyazova, Director of Uzbek-German Forum for Human Rights, and Bruce Spanier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlak Uwazi. Thank you, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was really nice to have you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.